Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhoman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhoman. Today, I'm welcomed by my good friend and co-host, Jennifer Hashley. Hey, Jennifer.
Hey, Aaron. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Yep, doing all right. Getting close to the holiday season. We were talking about the holidays leading into our conversation today. We'll get a couple weeks left. You're ahead of me. You got your tree set up. I'm a little bit behind the eight ball. We got to get after this.
I know. 'Tis the time of year to have holiday cheer. It starts earlier and earlier every year.
It does. It was like after Halloween this time, wasn't it? It was crazy. So. Hey, Jennifer, let me read a little bit about your background, and then we'll jump into our conversation today, which I'm quite excited by. Jennifer Hashley is the founder of the New Entry Sustainable Farming Project, which is one of the first initiatives nationwide to help immigrants and refugees develop commercial farming opportunities. Spawned out of the Tufts Friedman School, now 20 years in, Jennifer's goal remains to help new farmers excel in the field, and New Entry gives them the tools that they need to do that. It's a revolutionary program that looks at sustainable and regenerative farming as jobs creation, economic growth for regions often in need of stimulus. Additionally, you, in partnership with your husband, Pete, run a diversified pasture-based livestock operation and Pete and Jen's backyard birds in the Codman Community Farm in Lincoln, Massachusetts, which I've been to. It's a pretty spectacular spot.
It is pretty amazing, yes. We're about a mile from Walden Pond, and a nice place to be.
Yes, makes you want to write.
Yes, yeah. You have to be very, very introspective in Lincoln.
That's right, that's right. My kids took a training course for farming there at Drumlin, so we used to head out there, and I'm sure you get the free-range folks that walk all over your farm, all over the place doing things, and you're like...
One of the board members calls it the Stroller Brigade. I love that.
The Stroller Brigade, perfect. Jennifer, what we're going to talk about today is ethics. So... ethics are a set of moral principles, a theory or system of moral values, basically a guiding philosophy. I had to look that up in Webster Dictionary, just add that. So the notion of ethics has been top of mind and tip of tongue for many Americans and in many other democratic countries over the throughout the globe in the last few years. I'm not making any judgments here, but I want to talk about one specific thing. So Stephen Passantino, who's the former White House deputy counsel in charge of policy ethics for Trump's administration, earlier this week at a speaking engagement in Atlanta, offered a glimpse into what he said was an immediate and predictable chaos that followed after President Donald Trump finished taking the oath of office in 2017. It was quite an interesting read to hear what he was speaking about. You know, I left coming a bit empathetic to this cat, listening to what he had to say. You know, my first thought was, how can this guy compromise his values? Or maybe he saw this, that everyone else was compromising their principles, and he decided to put his foot down through sacrifice, personal sacrifice. Rex Tillerson may be an example of that as well. We've heard those stories throughout this administration that maybe people just stepped up to do this. Not compromising their values, but stepping it up so everyone else have. I found it fascinating because... you know, we're complex beasts here, right? When something disrupts our value system, it's easy to get up in arms. But what then? What do we do after that? And what makes us say enough? I wouldn't call the lackluster midterm election turnout to be a referendum on Trump's ethics. I'll just be honest and say it. Surprising. I thought it was going to be much higher,
yeah,
right?
I mean, I think we all did.
Yeah, it was a bit of a concern. I want to parallel this conversation of ethics because, again, it's totally around our moral principles. And we're going to put those, we're going to overlay those conversations into food, which is food is something that we can really better align your ethical decisions around what you believe in every day. Well, sometimes, or in theory, that's the case. This, too, goes layers deeper, of course, and becomes a challenging as you sift through the gray areas of what are these ethics. Where are we willing to compromise our value structure for what our kids eat? Is it the price? Is it the year-round availability for something fresh? Is it the impact on the environment or the labor force or animal well-being? What's been crazy enough to disrupt the apple cart and make us change our food buying practices. What is the sequence that leads us to this? Because it's happened. We've seen it in food categories, but why does it happen in some and not others, which is quite interesting. And if you take a step back and look at some of those categories it's happened in, you kind of scratch your head and think, well, I would have thought it would have been a different one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's about ethics choice that account for those externalities, where they tie into that principles or decision-making. So I'm excited for our show today because our guest can hopefully shed some light on this. His work over the last 50 years has reframed our perspective on ethics in food and animal management and what the resulting impact means for each of those stakeholders, including the sentient stakeholders, which I guess are all of them. Today, we welcome Dr. Alan Goldberg of Johns Hopkins. Hey, Alan, how are you?
I am well. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. This is quite an honor for us. I've known your history for quite a while. We had a chance to recently meet, and I was enthused by some of the things that you're working on. So I'm going to read a quick bio, and then we'll jump into the questions. Dr. Alan Goldberg is a professor of toxicology and founding director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Alternatives to Animal Testing, and a principal of the Berman Institute of Global Food Ethics and Policy Program. In 2007, he was appointed to the Pew Commission on the Impact of Industrial Farm Animal Production. Dr. Goldberg has served on several administrative positions at Johns Hopkins. He was the associate chair of the Department of Environmental Health and Sciences, director of Division of Toxicology, and for 15 years was the associate dean at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. As dean, he was responsible for research with specific responsibilities for transferring technology transfer, conflict of interest, and work with the private sector. So, Dr. Goldberg, you have an impressive 50 years at Johns Hopkins. Can you tell us a bit more about your background fighting for ethical treatment of animals and the planet and how that's folded now into the Bloomberg School of Public Health?
Thank you. And thank you for that introduction. January is 50 years. I came for three. We didn't even unpack our boxes. And every time I looked at a position, my colleagues and my activities at Hopkins were better than what I was looking at. So I stayed. And after 7 years, we moved across the street into a larger home and we unpacked our boxes. And we still laugh about that at this point in time because it's now 50 years. I'm a toxicologist professionally, got my degree at Minnesota University of, and then did some postdoctoral work at the University of Indiana. Was there for a few years and then moved to Hopkins. My initial activities at Hopkins were really classic toxicology, looking at what makes chemicals not good for us. And then about 10 years into my activities, the question I asked about a pesticide led me into tissue culture techniques. And this was very early on in tissue culture in the world of toxicology. And as such, the work became known that there might be another way to look at toxicity and the basic biology. And I was approached by the Cosmetic Toiletry and Fragrance Association to see if I could help them get out of the required animal testing and into non-animal testing. And in 1981, we founded the Center for Alternatives to Animal Testing, which was really a science-based program to look at how one can do risk assessment using in vitro methodologies, human tissue and culture, computer modeling, and decrease our use of animals in toxicity. What was also becoming apparent at that point was that the use of animals was actually strained scientifically in that it wasn't giving the answers that were necessary. And probably 10 years into the activity, I had some industrial colleagues at a meeting publicly stating that they spent the 2 years doing the necessary animal tests required by the regulatory agency. And then they spent the third year explaining away the results they got with animals because they were not correct. That still is happening. We're still not out of animal testing where we should be. But we have moved very, very far within the cosmetic and toiletry world, but not in some of the other areas where we need to be there. About the center was operating quite nicely, and I was asked, because of my interaction both with industry, with the animal activist community, and being an academic, if I would serve on the Pew Commission that was going to look at the impact of industrial farm animal production on four areas: animal welfare, environment, public health, and social justice. And this was a 3+ year project that had 15 commissioners, about 4 or 5 academics, several people from industry, several people from other aspects, like politics, to look at these issues. It was chaired by the governor of Kansas. So it had a political regulatory bent, and the idea was that we would look at how we produce farm animals, what their impact is, and what regulation and legislative change could we provide or stimulate to have happen in the United States. Well, the first thing that I really learned was that our food system was broken. I was looking at a system that was clearly not sustainable and clearly had public health consequences that had yet to be understood. This was early on. This was 2007, 2008.
This was at the precipice of the local food movement, right? So this was when everybody, all the films and, you know, farm...
Yep.
The exposés.
Yes. Michael Pollan's book and, yeah, Food Inc. and all of those films started to kind of put this in the spotlight.
Yes, it did, and that was a really good thing for us. But the amazing thing is the report to this day is still cited as the classic important document that deals with the issues of farm animal production, industrial farm animal production. Regulatorily, we had zero impact. Zero. I mean, and I, as a non-political person, I was shocked at this. Here we were presenting this fantastic science that was well documented, coming from a very broad array, and yet politically we had absolutely no clout. And that's when I decided that there had to be, for me, another approach. And I will tell you that the other commissioners all did things as a result of this report somewhat differently and went out to change the system that we currently live and still live with to a great degree. So my approach was to say that I think as an academic, we can do things that will help the consumer understand how their food is produced, what the impact is on these important areas of environment and public health and so forth, and to begin to change the system by market-driven forces. Mm-hmm. That was the basic concept. I approached my colleague, who was the head of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, and asked her, name is Ruth Faden, and asked her if she would participate with me in trying to develop this kind of program. And she immediately said yes, as she's obviously had been thinking about it for a while. And we together went out and got funding to set up a project at Hopkins that would initially look at what is the landscape, where does ethics fit in into defining a food system? And what are the big issues? Where are the big disagreements? And who do we have to help us understand this? So we put together an international group of individuals and talked through and wrote papers about the different aspects of food ethics. And we really had a magnificent team of people. At the end of that first three-year period, we had identified seven areas in the world of food ethics that we thought could be addressed in about a five-year period of time. And we called that report the 7x5 and went out and sought funding to begin to implement these projects. We did get funded. And the one project that I took on as the one for me was the one that dealt with food ethics, labeling, certification issues, consumer information. So that period, that project, has at this point in time developed essentially what we think of as the first principles of food ethics. What are those issues that one has to be concerned about? Not what are they specifically, but what do you have to be concerned about in a way that you can address the food issues so that a consumer will be able to identify what they want to participate in. And simultaneously, it ends up being a roadmap for industry on how best to enhance what they do and to practice a more ethical approach to the food that they produce.
So there's been a lot of traction in this, I feel like, over the past many years with the initiatives of the Humane Society of the United States and others, groups that are really pushing to change certainly the animal production system. There's been a rise in veganism and vegetarianism. Do you feel like your report and these working groups that came out of this really helped spawn a lot of that growth in this movement?
Well, we are certain that the Pew Commission report, which was titled Putting Meat on the Table, is one of those factors. As you mentioned earlier, Michael Pollan's book had already appeared. Many of the movies were yet to come. But the beginning awareness has happened, and this gave it the scientific basis, the rigorous approach that said, wait a minute, these are important issues, these are what they're recommending, and these are ways that we can move forward to do this. I think the shock to me still is that it seems like everybody I know is involved in this activity, and they are. But if you go out to the big world, we're talking about a very small percentage of people still.
Yeah. Let me ask Alan around that. Let me ask that because I think Jen and I are both very familiar with your 2007 report. It's kind of a foundational report for people within the space. But we have a lot of listeners that are less immersed into that. So maybe you could share, if you would, some of the findings. Specifically, how did we compare in these ethical treatment of animals compared to other developed countries?
Who are now adopting our practices, right?
Who are now adopting our... Perfect. That's exactly correct. We produce a lot of very inexpensive animal protein at the supermarket level. The problem is that we pay a very high cost for that at a very different level. Let me give you just one example, and it's a very important one. The amount of antibiotics that are used in food animal production takes up 80% of all antibiotics produced. So 20% of antibiotics are used to treat disease in humans, and 80% are used in animals, but not to treat disease. They're used in what's known as non-therapeutic levels. That means below an effective approach, because they increase the growth of the animals. So here we are growing animals with antibiotics that are not therapeutic. And what that means is that we're creating disease bacteria. MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, which everyone worries about if you're going into the hospital, is a direct result of the misuse of antibiotics in farm animal production. And that's a realization that the Pew Commission report held out. When we started, it was not certain, but there was some proof. By the time the report was done, there was no question. And we have been fought, and the FDA has not been terribly responsive. The FDA changed the rules to say you should not use antibiotics for growth promotion on a voluntary basis, but you can use antibiotics to protect against disease. Well, it ends up that the language and the process by which you, quote, protect against disease is identical to the process that you use for growth promotion. So since the FDA made that decision, the use of antibiotics has actually increased rather than decreased. And here we are producing methicillin-resistant bacteria, a very horrible disease.
Maren McKenna, I don't know if you've read her book, Big Chicken. She does a very nice job in layman's terms talking through the evolution of the poultry industry and specifically antibiotic use and resistance. And it's quite shocking and eye-opening to read that. I hope she gets some more press on that as well.
Who is this? I don't know a book by the title Big Chicken.
Maren McKenna, she's done a lot of work for the Food Environmental Reporting Network, but she's an author and has done some deep journalistic research on different aspects. And one of her new book that she put out is called Big Chicken, and it describes how the poultry industry evolved and really the result of use of antibiotics and how dangerous that is to global health and human health over time. And it's an easy read. I mean, it's very, sound and scientifically based, but it's also put in the context of something that, the average consumer can understand and get behind in a nice, pleasant way. So,
yeah, that's good to hear. The other one that I'm familiar with is Ellen Silvergill's book, Chickenizing Farm to Fork, which deals essentially with the exact same thing. Great. What Ellen says, though, I think is very important for this discussion. She points out that big ag is an industry, except it is not regulated like a big industry. It has all kinds of exceptions. So if you were producing waste and were a chemical manufacturer, you have to deal with that waste in ways that does not affect or compromise the human population. But if you're a big farm, that waste happens to be animal guano, and it's a large amount. And in fact, in the case of pigs, it's an unbelievable amount. And we have no regulations on how that has to be handled. So agriculture is an exception in almost every case for regulation. And that's one of the big problems.
It is fascinating because when we get into these situations, when we don't know all the truths, and one of the ways of describing what we're talking about with food systems is a true cost of the actual food. And when the consumer or even folks within the industry don't know those true costs, it's a lot easier to maybe compromise those ethics that we're talking about of really what goes into producing food. If there is a never, never land to put all these externalities, if you're not looking at the issue with labor, if you're not looking at many of the things, the truth that Alan was speaking to. And I think another area of true costs, Alan, which came out in your Pew Commission report, was the connection of these prophylactic use of antibiotics in food animals and the impact on public health. The fact that we've got such an impetus towards superbugs in our hospitals, 2 million cases a year costing the healthcare system 23,000 lives and almost $25 billion, not all, but maybe tied to our shortcuts that we're using within food production. And that's not obviously calculated in your $2 pound of chicken. Right?
Right.
So let's talk about how this has matured, what we've developed this into. So in early November, you hosted and facilitated the Choose Food Symposium in Baltimore. It was a gathering to evaluate some of the core ethical questions of food and production. You had top brass speakers share insight on ethics and food labor, environmental impact, externalities, animal welfare, health risks and factors, and new technology were all on the docket. So, Alan, maybe you could share with our Aussie audience, what was your objective of the symposium, and will this be an annual think tank?
Okay. The symposium was put together with the process and the thinking that we would develop these core ethical commitments and we would share them. So we look at the symposium, although it's the end essentially of the grant that funded that, it is really the beginning of this project, because prior to us looking at these ethical issues and developing the background for them, they're out there in scattered pieces, but never all together. And we went through a process that was 2 years in the making, where we had seven outstanding academics from different parts of the U.S. and Europe each raise the questions that one has to be concerned about in their areas, like environment or like labor. And then we took those and began to look at how do we put together these, there was like 130 or 140 of these different issues, in a way that begins to make sense. And we came down to five areas where one, if you're trying to set up an ethical system, these five areas cover the bulk of that. That's environment, public health, animal welfare, labor, this is farm animal labor, and what's called the smallholder or farmer fishers ranchers. These are the people that own and operate small farms. They are responsible for the marketing. They are responsible for each aspect of it. And they're a fairly substantial group, but it's very hard for them to make a living because of the large integrated manufacturing and the way that the large integrators have controlled slaughter, have controlled the food that the animals eat. And in fact, today I read that Costco, one of the largest retailers, is now building its own chicken facility because it doesn't want to be beholden to the two largest chicken producers.
Hmm.
Interesting?
That's interesting.
To do things better
in terms of to change the narrative toward a better ethical treatment of poultry or the slaughter process, or just to get better pricing?
No, it'll be better in every aspect.
Oh, great.
I mean, I, their policies as a company that I'm aware of and the suppliers that they work with already do some of this. I mean, one of their suppliers for the area of pork is a company in Canada called Maple Leaf. And Maple Leaf actually presented at our symposium, and to see how they have handled intensified animal production is really quite remarkable, because they do have really intense production, but they do it in a way that the animals can express their own behavior. They have very clean facilities. There's a lot of other activities and interaction between the animals that make it very impressive. The other pork producer that we had at the symposium dealt with pastured pork, which is about the highest level you can get. It's Nyman Ranch. And their process, where you see the animals on pasture, where they live in hoop barns as families, this is remarkably impressive. I physically have visited their sites and did that. But when you say to them, can you even begin to produce the amount of pork? And they have 700 plus farmers that produce pork for them that way. You know, you say to them, can you produce pork in the amount that Maple Leaf can? They say, no, we can't even come close. Mm-hmm. So if we're going to feed the world and we're going to feed them nutritiously and in a humane way, we have to go through some of these kinds of discussions to figure out how to do it well. Costco was one of those companies.
that will do the chickens, I believe, quite well.
Right. Was because of out of the Pew report, the social justice aspect was there, and in the five categories that you just mentioned, is the smallholder kind of economic viability piece, is that where the social justice piece lives for you?
Exactly.
Okay, great.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, these smallholders, somebody in the family has to have a job outside the farm to make it work.
Absolutely.
Ellen, you mentioned that a lot of this is being consumer-driven or market-driven, and from your perspective...
No, that's what we're hoping for.
Sure, yeah, and I think we align with that perspective, that if there is an agent of change, it can be the consumer that will force the hand of production models and folks that are sourcing this type of food. And I completely understand what you're saying, that we almost have two different types of supply chains, right? We're trying to coax them into the middle. So we introduce more of these values and raise our minimum market threshold, so we get some of these bad actors out of the play here. But as a collective, have you seen a macro trend in your 50 years, or even since the Pew report since 2007, have you seen a macro trend of consumers' enlightenment towards better, more ethically well-sourced food?
I believe I have. The problem is my worldview. The people, it's not the world. But I am more and more convinced that I'm seeing the kinds of restaurants and chain restaurants that are beginning to do things that make more sense. Chipotle, Sweetgreens, and we can go on and on and on. That have taken this up as part of their stand, the farm-to-fork movement in the restaurant business, again, has taken this up. And like all of these things, they get modified if you're not careful. I was in a restaurant in Baltimore that talked about its farm-to-fork process. And the beef that was sold, I asked them, where do they get their beef? And they gave me the name of a farm. Well, that farm actually was a product line of Smithfield. There was nothing farm to fork about it. It was completely industrial production. So people are trying, but they're not. Not everybody got it all correct. And the cost is the cost at this point, which is greater, is not real. And by that I mean that the cost that we're paying for organic farm-to-fork type local production is higher, much higher, than the industrial. But the process is that you're paying that because we will pay that. As competition increases, those prices will begin to drop. A very real example, which we had in the Pew Commission report, was that we looked at an egg laying facility that had converted from battery cages to a very open system using the building without the battery there. So these chickens had the ability to dust bathe, to actually flap their wings as freely as they wanted to eat bugs, to have fresh, clean water and food and a nesting place. And the facility went from 45,000 chickens to 28,000 chickens. So that's a substantial drop, but still very large. The cost of the egg that was produced in this much better facility was 1 cent more than the cost in the battery cage. However, when you went to the retail store to buy those same dozen eggs, that penny translated to about 10 cents.
And then there's the other extreme, like our operation, where we're raising 1,000 chickens or 1,200 chickens, and we're out there moving them on the field every single day and collecting the eggs in buckets by hand and moving the fencing and hauling feed and water out there and making sure reseeding the pasture and packaging them locally and then feeding them organic grain, and we have to sell them for $7 or $8 a dozen, and you look in the supermarket and the organic eggs there are $7 a dozen as well. And you look at the economies of scale and the labor and all the other factors. And sometimes consumers don't understand the difference between, even much better, more ethically better than caged chicken eggs. Then we get to the next level, but they're still inside a barn and still massive quantities. And then there's this boutique, small, very backyard kind of scale. And you know, you don't know where to put your dollars sometimes, or you don't really understand the real value behind what's happening in the marketplace. And you know, how do consumers make these choices when there's so much misinformation and greenwashing in front of them?
Yep, it's even those of us that know have trouble doing
That's right.
A real evaluation.
Yeah, if we're wondering, if we're around this table wondering, you know, that we're struggling with, that the average consumer scratches their head and say, I see 9 different egg types that are out there. And I think to your point, Ellen, which is quite good, if, you know, definitely the opportunistic restaurants or producers or even large corporations are jumping on the idea of the farm to fork. It's a non-regulated term. It's a bit like selling natural food, maybe the greenwashing being Jennifer's good example. So, you know, I left the Choose Food Symposium wondering if food ethics, what you're defining in these 5 buckets of food ethics, could be a common development language to do greater things in the world. Could food and production ethics be a rallying cry to better demonstrate that we're much more alike and we have similarity in interest and choice, and it gives the consumer what they're really looking for, which is accuracy and integrity. So am I getting too excited about this, Alan? Is this a pipe dream that I'm talking about, or is this just us talking? Or do you think that there is some reality that you guys, through ethics, could define some new categories of interest for consumers to be involved in?
No, I think your enthusiasm is warranted. I mean, I really see this at a very personal level, because when people find out what I do, and any kind of social event outside my own, you know, circle of friends or bigger events, I see how enthusiastic people are to that topic, how they're really interested. Of course, it's hard to know if they translate that when they go into the store and they have a chance to buy their chicken for 29 cents a pound or $2.99 a pound. You know, they have to struggle with that. And part of the ethical consideration is how much protein animal-based do we really need? That's a very tough question to answer. We need much less than most of us get.
One of the things I was just thinking about related to just thinking about ethics and empathy, and I feel like this kind of question of animal welfare and this rise of veganism and other things, I feel like people are more, have a better sense of empathy for animals. And as you were talking earlier about the cosmetic industry, I feel like that's, as you said, that's flourished. People care. They don't want to be wearing skin products and furs and other things that have impacted animals. And now people are paying more attention to the food. And I guess I'm still waiting for that to jump one step further, because it's easy to, not easy. Obviously, we're talking about this. It's not easy, but there's empathy for animals as sentient beings, and that's a real physical thing, as we all have, you know, people have pets and you can see the animals and things like that. And then how do we take that back even a step further to connection to the soil, the land, and the community, which is kind of where it all starts? And I feel like there are people are, it's, this is like tip, you know, putting the toe in the water of caring about animal welfare, which is a great conversation starter for this movement. And then it needs to go even deeper than that across all the domains that you have mentioned in the 5 areas here. So I don't know if you can say where you see that. Where do you see that going? Or do you see that being even more complex and systems-based than people are ready for?
No, I think people are actually ready for it. The soil people have the understanding that if we really enhance our soil such that it is much more organic in nature, we become able to then take carbon out of the environment rather than putting it into the environment. I think when somebody sees the roots of a perennial wheat, which is 20 or 25 feet deep, against the 9 inches or 10 inches of roots on a regular stalk of wheat, it changes how they perceive things. And so I'm seeing the same kind of ethical thing with animals going into the environment going into raising crops, the kind of crops, how do we eat. I think the plant protein people sort of combine much of this in terms of producing products that now are all plant-based and have reasonably good taste. I had today at lunch, I had my first Impossible Burger. I have tried for about 6 months, and every time I've gone to somebody that has it on the menu, I get there and they're out. Today it was available. It was good. It was different than a hamburger. It was good.
And you're not glowing in the dark yet, right?
And I haven't checked completely. But there are people, very knowledgeable people, that are talking about the plant-based protein products have too many other chemicals being added.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a real question. I'm not making a judgment on it, but I think it's a question that has to be looked at, you know. So none of these are simple answers, but they all work. I mean, there are other companies now that are beginning to focus on what's called blended meats, where they're taking plant-based proteins, not grain, but plant-based protein, and mixing it with animal-based protein to make a product that has really good mouthfeel and flavor, and it's actually a better tasting meat. At the CIA, the Culinary Institute, I had what's known as a Sonic Burger, which is a burger that's two-thirds beef and one-third mushrooms. Hmm. And I was blown away. It was probably the best burger I ever had.
It's fascinating evolutions here, right? And I think just kind of closing this out by saying that we do make ethical decisions every day, and we balance these systems that they all intertwine with. It's always a challenge. I'm excited by the work that you're doing, Alan, at Johns Hopkins, with looking at these five buckets of ethics and being a new framework for how we can move the food system, make the consumer more aware, make them part of this decision-making process. So, Alan, is the best place for our listeners to learn more about your work and Choose Food, the Choose Food website and the Johns Hopkins website, Johns Hopkins website? Okay. I can include links to those. I'll put that at the bottom of the write-up. And then I'll also include any other key pieces of information, including the Pew Commission report. But Alan, I just want to say thank you so much for partaking in today's conversation. I learned a great deal. I know our audience will as well. So thanks so much for sharing the wisdom.
Oh, thank you very much. Enjoyed the conversation with you both.
And Jennifer, thank you so much for always adding your great insight.
Thanks, Aaron. And thank you, Alan. This is wonderful.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Thanks, Alan. Bye-bye.
You're welcome.